Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's show, our studio guest is Michelle Diskin-Bates, talking about Stand Against Injustice, the fight to clear the name of her brother Barry George, wrongly convicted for the murder of Jill Dando. We also hear from Peter Murphy, talking about his latest legal thriller, One Law for the Rest of Us. And we chat to Andy Shepherd, whose debut novel, The Boy Who Grew Dragons, has been shortlisted for the Waterstones Book Prize. Michelle, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you, Lee.
Nice to have you with us. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But we're talking to Peter Murphy later on about his legal thriller. I guess reading legal thrillers now, how does that feel for you? Do you read them? Can you enjoy them, given your experience of the legal system?
Oh, yes, I can definitely divorce the thriller from the real thing. I thoroughly enjoy them. So, yes, I'm sure that would be a lovely book to read.
Often in these books, there's a premise of the wrongly convicted man, though. That must strike a chord.
Yes, it does. Frequently, when I'm reading a book like that, I'm looking at the evidence. I'm looking to see where it's leading. Is it going the right way? Has a wrong turn been taken? Oh, no, they're talking about DNA and they've got it all wrong. This sort of thing. But, yeah, like that, I still enjoy them.
Good. Well, we'll, as I say, give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now, which is You'll Never Walk Alone by Jerry and the Pacemakers. Why this one?
Well, this one I found, it became an anthem, really, for the families of the 96 who were killed in the Hillsborough disaster. And, of course, they were victims of a huge miscarriage of justice, and it's only just recently been acknowledged as such. So this song, it gave hope to all of those people, those families who were campaigning for justice. And so I use it today to give the same sort of hope to the families of the wrongly convicted.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark. At the end of a storm, there's a golden sky and the sweet silver.
That's You'll Never Walk Alone by Jerry and the Pacemakers, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Michelle Diskin-Bates. Michelle's life was turned upside down following a train of events that began with the murder of TV presenter Jill Dando in April 1999. 2 years later, Michelle's brother Barry George, a man with severe mental health disabilities, was convicted and imprisoned for Jill's murder. Certain of her brother's innocence, Michelle tirelessly campaigned for his freedom, frequently finding herself at odds with both the British legal system and the media. But after 8 years in prison, Barry was acquitted following an appeal and retrial. His case remains one of the most high-profile miscarriages of justice in living memory, and Michelle now campaigns for others who find themselves in a similar situation. Stand Against Injustice gives her story of that turbulent time. Well, first of all, Michelle, why did you decide to write the book?
Oh, there were so many reasons for writing the book. I think the main one was that because whenever we would speak, it was up to whichever media was interested in what we were saying as to how much of it would be actually be reported. So many things were never reported. And all the way through, I just kept feeling the public are not being told the truth. They're not being told, and they need the truth. And, you know, there was so much propaganda against Barry as the defendant. And it was just quite shocking to me to find that there was so little truth out there. And so that was the main reason. I knew once I wrote my own words, nobody else could say, you can't have those words.
And how was it going back to that time and revisiting that period in your life?
It really was quite difficult, because in order to write it so that it would be interesting to people, I did have to actually go back into every single thing that I wrote about. And the book could have been four times the size it is. There is so much of it on the cutting room floor that it's amazing. But when you've got 19, 20 years to write about, there's a lot.
There is a lot. You've got a foreword by Dr. Michael Norton from the University of Bristol Law School. He describes it as disturbing, yet uplifting and inspirational, which seems that that's a brilliant description of it, particularly the part uplifting and inspirational, because although it's a story of the difficult time that you went through, there is optimism and there is love and hope. That's presumably what you wanted to convey.
Oh, I certainly did. It's a long journey, and I know of, you know, many families that are going along that same journey, and I didn't want them to feel that there's no hope. There is hope. You do have to just keep walking, but you can get there, and you take all the help that you can get along the way, and just maintain your integrity. And I got so much help from so many people, and Dr. Michael Norton actually was one of them. He was very inspirational as well.
Well, let's take you back to that time then, and the events that are in the book. Can you remember when you first heard Barry had been arrested in connection with Jill Dando's murder?
Oh, I certainly can. I was getting ready to go to a Bible study, and wasn't something I got the opportunity to do very much because at that time I was a mature student. So I was just standing in front of the mirror, getting a bit of makeup on and waiting for the news to come on the Irish radio. And I heard that they had found somebody, they had arrested somebody for Jill Dando's murder. Now, we were in Ireland, so really, Jill Dando's murder didn't impact us quite as much as it impacted people here. But at the same time, you know, we were interested in this, and I thought, oh, this is so good. It's been about a year, that poor family, they've not had any closure and they've not had any justice. So I just thought this was really good news. And then in the next sentence, she said, his name is Barry Bulsara. And that's when I went cold, because my brother used that name as his email address. And I wondered just how many people would be using that same name. And that's when I realised that something huge was happening.
And what were your immediate thoughts? He was innocent?
No, that wasn't my immediate thought. My immediate thought would have been, how on earth did we find ourselves here? We don't have any connection to Jill Dando. We don't have any connection to anybody. We're just a small family. And I didn't quite know how I would find out if it really was my brother. And I thought about ringing the radio station, and I thought, oh my goodness, don't be so stupid. Because if I rang the radio station, well, they'd immediately say, oh, there could be somebody living out there. So I had another sort of rummage around in my brain and a think about it. And I thought, in the end, I had to ring my mum. But I thought she'd think I was mad. And I asked, was there any problems? No problems. And I thought, I'll have one more push just to see. And I said, are you sure, Mum, that there isn't something that we can pray about this morning when I go to the Bible group? And she said, you could pray for your brother. And that's when I knew.
Well, tell us about your brother. Tell us about Barry. You looked after Barry, really, growing up, didn't you?
I did. I looked after my brother and my sister. And that wasn't unusual in those days. Most older siblings would have looked after younger siblings. The thing about Barry and Susan was that both of them had disabilities. Susan's were very clear. You could see it in her face, and she had very unstable epilepsy, and she had quite a definite low IQ. With Barry, it was less obvious. Where Susan would have had very severe seizures, Barry had the eye-blinking type. And so we didn't sort of think that that was a bad thing. And
absences, they're called, aren't they?
They're called absences.
People just drop out of the conversation, the presence, yeah.
That's right. Whereas Susan would have, you know, she'd be on the floor writhing. So they were so different, we didn't realise until actually during the trial that Barry was born with an abnormal brain. So although his seizures only look like absent seizures, he actually has seizure-type electricity going through his brain all of the time, which causes confusion and, you know, he would get overwhelmed by things quite easily because he loses track. We didn't know either until the trial.
It's all right. That fire alarm bell goes off every time we record. It's fine. It's
just as long as I didn't set it off, that's fine. Yes, but he has this electrical current going through his brain all of the time. He also has ADHD, though he's no longer hyperactive. That bit we did know about. But he also has the brain damage. And the brain damage is where his short-term memory is stored. So you could tell Barry something, and in just 5 minutes, Barry's forgotten. So he really only sort of can register with his long-term memory.
And what was your relationship with him at the time that he was arrested?
Well, at the time he was arrested, we were living in two different countries. That was simply because I went over to Ireland in 1973 and decided that was where I wanted to stay. But during that period, from sort of the 70s onwards, you didn't fly to Britain. It was far too expensive. And the boat took such a long time, and you didn't phone either, because, you know, you used to have to put, it sounds funny to young people, but you used to have to feed money into a box to make your phone call, and it was a lot of money. So we didn't have a great deal of contact. When I came to England, if he happened to be over at Mum's, then we'd see each other. Otherwise, we really didn't. But we didn't think anything strange of that. It is just how it was.
And after he was arrested, he was put in Belmarsh Prison, labelled a Category A prisoner. And you say in the book that was really the beginning of the building of the case against him for the media by the police.
Yes. I mean, the media weren't really allowed to say too much until he came to trial.
By making him a Category A prisoner, though, they made him sound dangerous.
Yes. Well, Category A is usually reserved for very dangerous people or people that maybe they want to keep relatives away from. So Category A, you have to go through a much more rigorous system to get to see them. So it is much more difficult. And it was a type of propaganda. And I didn't know, but I think nobody really realised that I was on the scene. So they knew Barry had a mum, and they knew he had a dad, but they didn't realise that I was there, and they also didn't think that anybody was going to fight. And I came along, and I have a very strong faith in God. And I asked God, what should I do? And he told me to stand, which was a bit of a strange answer. So I went back and said, no, God, you're going to have to give me a bit more than that. So he said, I want you to stand up for your brother. and I want you to stand in front of your family. And I want you to stand against injustice, hence the name of the book. So I thought, well, if that's all I have to do, that can't be too bad, can it? Yeah. Some hopes on that one.
At the beginning of the book and your journey, you say how, because there was really so very little evidence against Barry, that you thought, well, that this is going to be an open and shut case. This is clearly innocent.
Absolutely. The evidence against Barry was all circumstantial. There wasn't a single thing that linked him to the death or even to Jill. Everything was just strands that were pulled together and they ended up as a web, and Barry was caught in the web. But there was nothing to link him. There was no blood, there was no DNA, there was no sighting of him standing there with a smoking gun, there was nothing.
And examining the details of the case, it seems very clear it's an execution, what happened to Jill Dando. Very clinical, very cold. Barry was quite a chaotic person.
That's quite true. I mean, it has all the hallmarks of being an execution. It also has the fact that the person who carried out that killing was a left-handed person. Well, Barry's right-handed. And just technically, if the person had been right-handed and had shot Jill in the manner she was shot, they'd have shot themselves through the left arm. It was an impossibility to actually grab her, shoot her, if you were right-handed in the way that she was killed.
Well, thank you, Michelle. We'll come back to you and talk more about that very shortly. We mentioned Peter Murphy at the top of the show. Let's hear from him now. Peter spent a career in law as an advocate and teacher in the UK and the US. He's written 2 political thrillers about the American presidency and 5 legal thrillers. His latest in the Ben Schroeder series, One Law for the Rest of Us, was described by The Times as an intelligent amalgam of spy story and legal drama, and Historical Novel Review said it was an excellent read from start to finish. When I met Peter, I asked him to tell me what the novel was about.
Well, it's about a rather dark subject, child sexual abuse and the cover-up of child sexual abuse. I've put it in the 1970s because, as you may know, recent events shed a lot of light on what was going on during that decade. And although nothing very concrete has been proved, clearly a lot of stuff was going on then and wasn't reported at the time. And ever since the Jimmy Savile episode and other people who've been caught in similar situations, it's been a real, well, a very important subject. As you know, you can't really watch television news or read a newspaper now without some story almost every day. We've got this long-running public inquiry that had such a bad start and has apparently alienated various victims groups, but which is continuing. And from other countries too, Ireland, the United States, Australia, it seems to be a worldwide phenomenon. And I thought the time is right to write about this. And this is a novel. It's not based on any actual facts, but it is a story of a woman who discovers that she has recovered memories of her abuse at a religious school. She has sent her daughter to that same school because she didn't realize the problem till her memories came back. She now realizes my daughter's having the same problems I have. And she devotes herself to trying to stamp it out through the courts and using the law. And actually, I must give readers a warning about this. It's on a dark subject. Parental guidance, definitely. It's got some very bad language and some very graphic sexual scenes. These are not gratuitous. I've discussed them in depth with my editor while I was writing, and we both agreed that to deal with this subject, we had to deal with it, frankly.
You've not been afraid to tackle big subjects before, have you?
No, I try. The arrangement I made with my publisher when the Ben Schroeder series started was it didn't have to be all about Ben. We said, look, let's deal with interesting subjects. Ben can play a bigger part in some novels, a lesser part in others. Yeah, and I've written about terrorism. I've written about the Cambridge spies. And so a lot of different things which interested me and my publisher and we wanted, thought were important, you know, to write about and put out there.
And of course you've got experience as a resident judge and a circuit judge.
Yes.
How much of that do you bring to these novels? Are these distillations of cases? I know you wouldn't recreate cases for confidentiality purposes, but are they memories of cases that you've presided over?
No, or to a very, very small extent. These novels are now almost technically historical novels. They're set in the 1960s, 1970s, when I was a barrister. But they're really more my memory of practice in those days. I have also done another series, the Walden of Bermondsey series, which is quite different. It's a series of really humorous and satirical short stories, which are based very much on my experience as a judge.
And this is the sixth novel to feature Ben Schroeder. Is
yes.
he changing, evolving?
Yeah, he's getting older. He's married now. He's got a child as of the one before this. So, yes, things are changing for him. He's becoming more senior in chambers. He's more confident. You know, he started out feeling a bit unwanted because back in the 1960s, unless you'd been to the right school, the right university, you were a white male. It seems odd to say this now in this day and age, but looking back, it really was like that. It was difficult for women. It was difficult if you didn't meet the traditional model. So Ben is a very bright young man, but he's a Jewish kid from the East End. So he didn't go to the right school, didn't go to the right university. And he has a lot of trouble getting started. He has a bit of a complex about that. But now he's had some success. He's getting more senior. He's becoming part of the furniture. You know, he's gradually gaining in confidence, I think.
And it seems that fiction and drama about the legal world becoming more and more popular. Why do you think that is?
I think everybody likes a good court scene. And if you look at what's on television currently, there's a huge proportion of them that have courtroom scenes or at least are involved with detection, crime work and so on. I think people like that. They like to see a trial. They like to see the foreman of the jury get up and say guilty or not guilty at the end. There's an inbuilt drama, which isn't, by the way, necessarily present in the real courtroom. Sometimes that can be very boring and humdrum, but in the context of a novel, it can be made to be quite exciting.
Yes, how accurate do you be? Because as you say, a lot of legal procedure is quite boring and time-consuming.
Yeah.
You must need to cut that out for the purposes of pace and drama.
I do to some extent. Since I've been conscious of writing historical novels, I try my best to set the atmosphere as it would have been at that time. And, you know, I've had a couple of reviews that said, well, you know, why doesn't he lighten up and use more contemporary language or do this, that and the other? But the answer is, well, I'm writing a historical novel and I want to give people the feel of what the courtroom was like then. I do alter it, of course. I mean, I'm very conscious that the story needs to move on and it has to be interesting. So I'm not doing it exactly as it would have been. But I do like to keep that. I mean, there were so many dramas that you read or see on television where that's all gone out of the window and where what's happening is bears no relationship at all to what would go on in the real courtroom. I don't like that personally.
So how far ahead do you plan? Ben will move forward, Ben's life will move forward as time moves forward. How far will you bring it up to?
The object, when I started out, and I think this probably will happen, I wanted to bring him to the Yugoslavian War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. And I wanted to do that because I was there for a decade as an advocate. And it made a deep impression on me, and I wanted to write about that. Now, I think I can do it. The tribunal is set up in 1993, by which time Ben has been around for quite a while. He's getting quite senior, if I can put it politely, by that time. But I think I can just do it. I've got another one first before I get to that, which is going to be about the other thing I really wanted to write about, the old flying squad in the 1970s, which was a notoriously corrupt force. And I think after that, we're going to have a long leap forward in time. And Ben is going to go to the tribunal.
How's that going to be, writing about that for you when it made such a deep impression on you?
I don't know till I start. I suspect it might be difficult, because it's very difficult subject matter, dealing here with cases of war crimes, genocide. There's no way to dress these up. I mean, they are just very unpleasant subjects to deal with. But at the same time, there were some interesting personal stories from that tribunal, because people always used to say to me, how can you represent these people? And I would say, what people? Yes, there are some probably two or three genuinely evil people who've been brought before this tribunal, but a lot of these people are caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. their society falling down around their ears. Nothing left. No leadership. Militias roaming everywhere. And they make some bad decisions. Yes, they must be accountable for that, of course. But there's some very, very human stories. And there's some stories about people who escaped. So it's not just about the horror of war crimes. It's really a much bigger story. But I think I'm going to have to take some time with that one.
So you were on that side of the tribunal, were you?
On the defence side, yeah. Yeah.
How did you come to be involved in that?
I was teaching for many years in America in a law school in Houston. I had a student who went out, graduated, opened her own legal practice. She's a criminal defence lawyer. I didn't see her for a number of years. And one day she comes to my office and says, look, I went over to The Hague. I asked for a case. They gave me one. We've been in trial for 18 months. It's going to go on appeal because I know we're going to be convicted. Would you like to help? And I said, yeah, that sounds very interesting. That turned out to be actually two appeals, and it lasted a very long time. And so in the meanwhile, while I was there, I'm getting to know other lawyers, including a lot of lawyers from the former Yugoslavia who were there and who didn't have the confidence to work in a system where English and French were the working languages. And so we Western lawyers worked with them, and I got asked to do other cases, and I ended up being there for almost 10 years.
Wow, 10 years. I mean, that must have been life-changing, the things you heard there.
I still haven't probably processed it entirely. There's an immediate emotional effect the cases have on you. That was the only situation where we had legal interns. You know, I had a lot of interns from various law schools. And we had to give them detailed instructions about security, about not talking about the cases. But that's standard in any sort of internship. But we added to that, it's okay to cry. Because you'll be sitting in the office sometimes, and you will. And don't worry about it. We all do it, you know. It was a very interesting experience, and one that I'm glad I had. And I'm glad I don't have to do again.
So what's next for you now, then?
The Walden and Bermondsey series has attracted a lot of interest. It was optioned recently for the TV rights, which means that a producer buys the right to exploit those rights for a period of 18 months. And that's renewable for another 18 months. And I know why now, because these things take a very, very long time. And we've put together some documents to sell the project to a TV company. We've been talking to scriptwriters. And one very interesting thing that I've never done anything like this before, but I've sat down with the producer a couple of times and we've gone through a list of actors and say, wouldn't he be good or wouldn't she be good? Yeah, really amazing. And who knows what any of these people would be remotely interested. But it's fun to do. And we're now at the point where it's getting serious. We've made an approach to a TV company. Initial feedback is that they like it. But there are many hurdles. Depends what they want, what they're seeing 2 or 3 years ahead. So there's no way to know. But it's very exciting. I've got one volume. We've had 2 volumes published of these stories. The third one will be out in June.
And One Law for the Rest of Us by Peter Murphy is published by No Exit Press. On Bookmark today, our studio guest is Michelle Diskin-Bates, talking about Stand Against Injustice, her memoir of her fight to clear her brother Barry George's name. Barry was accused and convicted of the murder of Jill Dando. Michelle, Peter there talking about covering police corruption when he was talking about maybe writing something about the flying squad. You never said in your book that it was corruption that ended with Barry's conviction for Jill's murder. Why? Why do you think Barry was the police target for the murder?
Well, I couldn't say that it was corruption because I would have had no proof of that. And I didn't want my book to not have integrity. I wanted people to be able to trust what I was writing. And so only if I had proof of something would I actually write that. We do know that at the very beginning, there were 12 officers on the Dando case, and they had a discussion about whether or not they should take the case forward with Barry as the defendant. And 6 of them said no. The other 6 said yes. So the first 6 left, and the case went forward with the second 6.
Wow. Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, which is Labi Siffre and Something Inside So Strong. Why this one?
I just feel that it's very uplifting for people to just to hear that. It always had quite a profound effect on me. And so, sorry, I'm kind of losing my train of thought here a little bit. Because I'm still actually with the guy talking about his book there. It was very interesting.
Well, this is a kind of upbeat song, isn't it? It's an optimistic, positive song. And I suppose it talks about calling on inner reserves, which you certainly had to do.
Oh, most certainly. And the thing about it is, too, that a lot of the people that I'm on the periphery of their cases, I don't take people's cases, but I'm on the periphery of a lot of families who are fighting and their loved one is in prison. And I want them to have something that will uplift them and that they can do it. Keep going. If Barry got there, you can get there.
Mark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And on Bookmark today, we're talking to Michelle Diskin-Bates about her memoir, Stand Against Injustice, the fight to clear her brother's name of the murder of Jill Dando. Michelle, given what we were talking about before, the lack of evidence against Barry, his characteristics, his personality, which clearly pointed away from the way that Jill Dando was killed, how did it feel when he was found guilty?
That was probably the most shocking day ever, because I wasn't the only person in the courtroom that thought it would be a not guilty verdict. I looked around the court as the jury foreman was giving the verdict, and strangely, he caught my eye, and I had the impression he wasn't going to be happy with what he was saying. And he said, guilty, and there was silence, and then there was scraping and noises as people shot out of their chairs and rushed out of the court in order to be the first to get the news out to the waiting world. And I looked over at the prosecutor and his mouth was hanging open. And I thought, he's as shocked as we are.
Even the prosecutor didn't think it would be a guilty verdict?
No, because everything that the prosecutor skillfully put across, I have to say that Michael Mansfield countered. Of course, what I did find out was that only what the prosecutor said ever managed to make it to the news or to the newspapers. Anything that Michael Mansfield countered it with never made it.
So why do you think they did find him guilty?
It's very hard to know for sure, but there's a possibility that, one, that the court took so long debating about a single particle of gunshot residue. It went on for over a week. And so at the end of it, they must have thought, well, it has to be important, because why would they spend so much time on it? So even though Michael Mansfield was well able to show that it meant nothing, I think that the jury may have thought to themselves, look, let's convict and let the Court of Appeal sort it out.
And did you know then that you were going to fight it?
Oh, no. On the day that that we got that news, I do remember that I did mouth to Barry as they were taking him down to the cells, we'll fight. But the absolute dejected look on Barry's face, he was totally stunned and totally overwhelmed. And as I left the court then, I don't even remember things. I don't remember, because it was such a shock.
Thank you, Michelle. We'll come back to you in just a moment. Let's take a sidestep now and hear from Andy Shepherd. The Boy Who Grew Dragons is Andy's debut novel. It's the first in a trilogy and has been longlisted for the Blue Peter Book Awards and shortlisted for the Waterstones Children's Book Prize. The overall winner of the Waterstones Prize will receive £5,000, and previous winning titles include The Hate You Give by Angie Thomas and Rooftoppers by Catherine Rundell. When I met Andy, I congratulated her on the shortlisting and asked her what it would mean to win.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was very unexpected, and I'm completely delighted.
Does it mean more to you because it's your debut novel? It's first time out.
Yeah.
There you are. Shortlisted. How wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you write and write and write, and I've spent a long time writing and trying to get published. So to have it out in the world and getting a good reaction is amazing.
And where did the idea for the novel come from?
It came very much from my own children. When my son was very little, we used to be in the car, and like most kids, they get very fractious about being in traffic jams. So I made up a story about a dragon who would lift us out of the traffic jam and take us to the beach where we were going. And from then, we just had this dragon who lived in our garden, and he used to live on our shed roof and just part of our lives. And then when my youngest son was born, he started asking all these awkward questions about the dragon, about, you know, where did he come from and why couldn't he see him all the time and how come Ben saw him and I didn't, and, you know, all of that sort of thing. So I had to come up with more story. And so I started thinking about where this dragon would come from and why he was in our back garden. And I knew I wanted to keep it very local to our lives. So I was sort of walking past the allotments down the lane one day and just sort of thought, wow, what if this dragon grew on a plant and have to be this amazing plant to grow a dragon? So as I was walking home, I was sort of thinking about all what this tree might look like. And then I suddenly thought, you know, isn't there a dragon fruit? And I was like, well, that would be good. So I went home and looked it up because I'd seen a fruit, but I'd never seen the tree. And the trees are just amazing. They've got these cactus leaves that sprout out. They have tendrils that come out that look like a burst of flames. Got a moon white flower that blooms for one night. So it just wrote itself, and I was just like, that's the gift, that's the thing that takes it to another level.
Well, you say wrote itself. I mean, it's one thing to tell a story,
yeah,
and then to sit,
yeah,
down and write
it. It didn't write itself.
I mean, was it, how was that? Have you written before? Have you always wanted to be a writer? Did it come naturally?
I've always wanted to be a writer, and I'd spent a lot of time pretending I was a writer without writing anything. I just, in my head, I was like, I'm a writer, but I just hadn't actually written anything. And then when my sons went to school, I decided to really have a go. So I wrote my first novel, and it was very much a kind of, I'm going to sit down and see if I can write a book, because I've no idea if I got that many words. So I wrote this first book, and that's the book that got me my agent. And we got very close with the publisher, but it was too quiet. So I wrote another book, and that got another rejection. And at that point, I was very close to thinking, okay, perhaps I'll just write for me and the children. And so I went back to writing what I really loved writing. At the point that I was looking at what I was going to write, this dragon story kept coming back into my head. And I'd written it as a picture book originally, and then I'd played with it a bit longer, and it had kind of got a bit longer. And then I thought, right, I'm just going to write this because the boys love it. I'm just going to write it for them. So I wrote it over the course of a few months with them, every day writing a bit, and they'd come home and they'd read it. And eventually I'd finished this book and sent it to my agent, and she took it to London Book Fair, and it just got all this interest. It was lovely going back, and I'd kind of got to the point where I was thinking, is this going to happen? I didn't want to just write something by looking at the market and thinking, right, that's what I need to be writing. I thought, I'm just going to go back and write what I want to write. And that's why it's quite nice that it's the one that's made it out into the world.
And those first two books, were they children's books as well?
Yes, so they were both for 8 to 12-year-olds, whereas this one's slightly younger, for 5 to 10. Hopefully they will find a home one day.
I'm sure they're being re-examined,
yeah,
as we speak.
So.
But it was always that genre or that age group, that reader that you were interested,
yeah,
in.
Yeah, that's the age that I became a reader. And I love that age of 7, 8, 9, 10, where you're just absolutely locked into the book. So I knew that's where I wanted to be writing. And that was the age my kids were at the time. So those were the kind of stories I was surrounded with and that I was telling them. And so that's kind of what came out.
And this is the first of a trilogy?
Yes. So The Boy Who Grew Dragons, and then The Boy Who Lived With Dragons, and then The Boy Who Flew With Dragons. And they were originally this one book. And when I met the publisher, they wanted it to be slightly shorter for the age group. And I'd already tried rewriting it for another publisher, much shorter, and it hadn't really worked. So when I met them, I pitched it as a three books, so I could tell the story over three books, and they were really excited about that, and it was brilliant for me because I got to develop it even further. So the whole arc is the original arc that I had, but I've developed it over the three.
And some people who write trilogies say that the second book can often be the trickiest because you're trying to keep the momentum going, picking up the things that you started in book one and starting off things that you'll complete in book three.
You don't want it just to be a stepping stone. So I was very aware, and particularly for this age group, I wanted to make sure each book worked very much as an independent book. So you've got your overall arc of the three, and then each book needs to work as its own identity. So I hope that's what I've managed to achieve. Book number two, I think in some ways it makes you work harder, and often the middle one can then end up singing because you've actually had to really find what that story is in the middle part. I think my personal favourite is the third one, but, you know, that's just a personal favourite.
And how is it working with an illustrator? It's Sarah Ogilvy.
She's amazing. And when I met Piccadilly Press and they said they wanted it to be heavily illustrated, I was delighted because I love illustrated fiction and I'm a big fan of pictures in books, particularly for that age range. So when she agreed to do it, I was chuffed to bits. And I love her picture books that she does. And she has done another series, the Story Street books for Phil Earl. So I knew her work. She's amazing. All her pictures, they're so characterful and charming. And one of the things I wanted to get in the books was a real heart feeling. I wanted them to be full of heart. And I think her illustrations really capture that, which is lovely.
And what are the challenges of writing for that age group? I mean, as a practical challenge is about length of words, but subject matter, emotions?
I don't feel restricted at all. I mean, I don't dumb it down or anything. You know, in terms of vocabulary, I don't hold back. In terms of the emotions, I like to get some emotions in there. So it's a funny book. Thomas goes on a journey with his dragon Flicker, and it's all about the relationships with his families. He's got a very close relationship with his granddad. And there are moments there where he's learning some quite important things. You know, he's having to tackle some things about, you know, what it's like when you lie to somebody. He has to lie to his granddad about the fact that he has this dragon. Yeah, I don't feel it restricts me, and I quite like exploring that. And I like there to be a bit of humour and a lot of heart.
And how has life changed for you since you've written the book?
It's got busier. it's been wonderful. And I love the writing. I hadn't realised quite how much other stuff comes along with writing books. There's a lot of promotion, a lot of online promotion, a lot of building a website and making sure the book is visible, events obviously, and talking to schools and teachers and all of that side, which is a whole other part of it which I hadn't really considered, but obviously takes up a lot of time as well. So yeah, it's definitely busy.
And have you still got your own dragon?
Definitely got our own dragon, yes, we do. He's always going to be our family dragon.
And what next for you?
There's more books. I can't say exactly what at the moment, but yeah, I'm really excited about what's coming next.
Are you a full-time writer now then?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, so it really has changed your life.
Yeah, and I still wake up thinking this is a bit of a dream, really. You know, I get to read and write for a living. That's incredibly lucky, and particularly with children's books. It's a lovely community, and it's a very supportive community. I hadn't quite realised how many new friends I'd make, you know, particularly with children's writers. We're very supportive of each other, and it can be a bit lonely writing in your little bubble. So being able to meet up with other writers, Cambridge particularly has got a really good network of local writers and illustrators. So yeah, it's been lovely.
And what would it mean to you to win?
Oh, it would be incredible. Yeah, amazing. It would be lovely.
The Boy Who Grew Dragons by Andy Shepherd is published by Piccadilly Press. And good luck to Andy. The awards ceremony is on the 21st of March. We've been talking on Bookmark today to Michelle Diskin-Bates about Stand Against Injustice, her memoir about fighting to clear the name of her brother, Barry George, convicted of the murder of Jill Dando. Let's just really come to the end of the story, the legal story, at least. The day Barry was released, acquitted, you described it as a day of mixed emotions.
Very much a day of mixed emotions. We thought that it would be the most wonderful thing, that we would bounce out of the court. We would just be so very happy. And it didn't happen. And there's no way to explain what did happen. But I can tell you that another legal person said that arrogance got in the way and our joy was actually stolen from us. And there were legal issues, things such as innocent people when released do not go to probation. And there seemed to be this push to get Barry to go to probation. And I had been working with that particular thing with Barry's legal team for months. And every time that probation was mentioned, I said to them, Barry won't be going to probation. He will be an innocent man. And so we couldn't understand what was happening. And it was just, for me, it was just another battle that I had to go into. After the Birmingham Six situation and all of those well-known miscarriages of justice, the legal system had to make some changes. And one of those changes was that to support people who come out of prison who were wrongly convicted, they set up an organisation called the Miscarriage of Justice Support Services. And basically what they do is they support an innocent person to get back into normal life outside of prison. And it's a very difficult thing because you've lived in a very repressive kind of regime and there's no phased release. One day you are completely immersed in prison life and the next day you're out. And it could be that you're out on the street with no place to go and no one to be there with you. And so this organisation, they go into the prisons and they talk to the prisoners and they find out what their needs are going to be. So in Barry's case, it was where might we be able to get you to go and live? What will your needs be? Well, of course, for Barry, everything that he ever owned was gone. He didn't have a music system. He didn't have pillowcases. He didn't have pots and pans. He had nothing except the black refuse sack that he brought from prison. So how do you start your life with nothing? And yes, you know, there's the whole thing of compensation. But you don't get compensation the day you're released. If you're very fortunate, you get £46. But Barry didn't even get that because he didn't leave from the prison. He left from the court. If Barry hadn't had us on the outside waiting for him, Barry would have literally been on the street or sent to a bail hostel and probation.
And how is he now? How is Barry now?
Barry is still the same. He still struggles every day. But he does have some things that make life even harder for him than it was before. And that would be the fact that although he was found not guilty and it was a unanimous not guilty at a retrial, he has been told he will never get compensation. So because he had a retrial, the justice system says, well, that proves that we had evidence against you. So you're not a miscarriage of justice. But there used to be two systems of compensation available. One was for miscarriage of justice, and the other one was sort of like a gratuity that the government could look and say, yeah, OK, you don't quite make that category, but yeah, you make this category, so yes, you get some money. But that was taken away. So Barry gets nothing.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there, Michelle. Thank you so much. I could talk to you all day about it. I do recommend Stand Against Injustice by Michelle Diskin-Bates by MD Publishing, and it gives the full story, and it's a compelling read. Thank you, Michelle. We'll come back to you in a moment for your last choice of music, but just a heads up that the next show has kind of got a bit of a history focus to it. Our studio guest on the next show is Kelsey Wilson-Lee. She's talking about Daughters of Chivalry, the Forgotten Children of Edward I. We'll also hear from Jonathan Fennell about his book Fighting the People's War, the British and Commonwealth Armies in the Second World War. And Cathy Moore will be talking about what's coming up in the Cambridge Literary Festival. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Michelle. You talked about your faith before, and this is In Christ Alone by Keith Getty and Stuart Townend. Why this one?
Well, I chose this one because I believe it encapsulates everything that I believe as a Christian. And that's not always easy to explain to other people. I added the lyrics at the end of the book so that people would understand what it was that I believe. And I thought, well, you know, this is such a lovely song, and it's got a lovely Celtic vibe to it. And I thought it might be nice for people who have read the lyrics to actually hear the song.
In Christ alone, my hope is found. He is my life.